JR covered up, turns, and hits it. JR came to the ball, and he has hit three straight triples. LBJ turns the corner. Knuckleballs, soft touch off a rubber rim for LeBron. LeBron against Hazonia. Creating space off a rhythm, and he hit it. Isaiah Thomas, spin raging. There's the shot you called for. Again, Isaiah doing a good job rejecting the screen. Then he hits it for three. Corver, fake the pass, and drained it for three. Near steal by JR. Simmons spinning. Great finish. Simmons, they've got the lead. 21-point advantage evaporates. Inside on the stuff, though, that man Simmons. Rebound to Simmons. Here he goes again. Jonathan Simmons. Are you serious? He went all world on him. Uh-oh, they left him open. Oh, he passed up a three for a crush. Man, Cavs just getting out hustled. So just a 31-point second half. And the nine in the quarter.
I mean, it's just a culmination of our season, you know, pretty much. You know, we've had big leads this year, and we've lost them for whatever reason. They came out with a lot of such urgency. They drove our closeouts, you know, hit some big-time shots in the third quarter, and Simmons was really good in the third, obviously. So, you know, he just couldn't stop it. Once it, you know, the snowball kind of turned into an avalanche in the third, and 41-point quarter is hard to come back from. It's been tough because we have, you know, a few guys that's been struggling as of late, and we want to try to pick them up and not lose your, you know, your own individual ability to help the team. You know, it's no time to, you know, to throw shade about our season. We got to continue to be positive and continue to push forward. We got quite a few games left, you know, still serious about the season. And we got to, you know, now play some good ball, you know, at some point. Listen, I'm here for the long haul. You know, I'm here for this season right now to try to, you know, figure out ways we can still compete. And I couldn't give up on my teammates like that. I just couldn't do it. We put too much into the game, you know, every single day. We go out and prepare, even though win, lose, or draw. At the end of the day, we are brothers and we understand that. And I owe it to my teammates to finish the season out. No matter how it ends up, I would never wave my no trade clause.
They're a bad basketball team.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, they really are a bad basketball team. Tonight it really stood out to me because they got to score about 40 points in a 28-minute stretch. To a team that didn't have Aaron Gordon or Vucevic. First thing they don't do that other teams do in this league that are relevant, they don't fight through any adversity. I think what it really comes down to is when they hit a bad stretch in the game where they go five or six possessions and they don't score, their body language collectively shows no resolve whatsoever to start fighting back. And instead, they just splinter and fracture and it turns into what you saw tonight. So that is a real problem for a team that's supposed to be able to contend.
Like a lot of things. Football players, good students. But I think the thing I like best is those guys that really wanted to be at Michigan. Appreciate, you know, what Michigan has to offer, the football powerhouse and an academic powerhouse. I like the production in football games, guys that are record setters and they're state champions. If I was Shea Patterson, I would have the mindset of, well, where did they get a load of me? All three have the license and ability to be great.
We just signed 26 players with a very highly ranked class, a class that I think it follows suit the last two that we've brought in here as far as academic fit for Ohio State University, a culture fit, and a character fit. People ask the question, did you like the early signing period? We did very well. The majority of class was signed on that date. But it all worked out. January was far less drama, far less panic like you normally speak or normally you deal with in January. So I'm going to be curious to see how our colleagues feel about it.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, welcome indeed to Ye Old Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Is it unkind, Jim Cushlin? Is it inappropriate to chuckle a little bit when you hear a major college coach, a major university coach, talk about his recruiting class being first and foremost a great academic fit for our university? You know,
I don't care who says it. It makes me laugh every time.
I don't mean to be a jerk to Urban.
Right.
We love Urban, right?
Yeah.
How can you not? Toledo zone. Both those guys you just heard at the end of the montage, Harbaugh and Urban Meyer, Toledo babies, born in Toledo and have gone on to great things, obviously. I love Urban. But can you play that part of the clip again, Jim? I'll give you a second to grab it. But that just the very beginning of Urban Meyer's commentary there about the class that they're bringing in. And I think he said it, and I'm paraphrasing it now, that's why I want to play it again, but something to the effect of, it kind of follows suit with the last two classes they brought in, which is great academic fits for the university, as if the first thing they asked the guys that they have recruited isn't, you know, what's your 4.4 or your 40 speed and how many times you're repping out at 2.25 like they do at the combine, or I want to see stats from your senior season or maybe your junior season when we started looking at you, as if the first thing they say is, who's your favorite author?
Right.
Give me your favorite thing about pre-calculus. Tell us about your favorite science. Are you a chemistry, a physics, or a biology person? Or maybe you're earth sciences. Maybe you like geology. Tell us about those things first. And oh, by the way, can you catch? No, I don't think they're doing that. Oh, by the way, can you run? How strong are you? Excuse me. I got that out. What was your last quarter's GPA? Let me play this again.
We just signed 26 players in a very highly ranked class, a class that I think it follows suit the last two that we've brought in here as far as academic fit for Ohio State University and right. Culture fit. And
Find me the coach who first is worried about whether or not it's the right academic fit for our university. Find me. And I'm not, like I said, it's Urban who said it, so it sounds like I'm picking on Urban. I'm not picking on Urban. Find me the major college coach who is first concerned about whether or not the players they're considering offering a full scholarship to play football for the university, whether or not they are first academic fits for the university. The answer to that question, by the way, won't even be Duke. It won't be Stanford. It won't be Notre Dame. Those are all extraordinarily prestigious academic universities, yes? You've got to be a really good student just to get into those schools. However, those are things that the coaches push off to the admissions counselors and the academic people, and they say, we want this guy. He's the linebacker we need. Can you get him in? And then they look and see what the transcripts are, and they look and see what the grades are. They look and see what the are they National Honor Society and so on and so forth. You don't go through high school as a 2.2 student and get into Duke. It doesn't matter if you run a 4.4. It doesn't matter if you can leap out of the building. You're not getting in. You got to be smart. Same thing, like I said, there's a lot of institutions like that. So I'm not saying that all schools allow dummies in. But the coaches, don't tell me that the first thing they ask or they talk about is whether or not they fit in academically. Jim, go ahead.
It's like that, it feels like that same excuse, you know, why we can't have a first round expanded playoff. Oh, it'll get in the way of finals. Yeah, that ballroom dancing finals, super tough. Got to study for that.
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah, you know, like they aren't taking finals at Mount Union. They don't have finals.
Right?
Right? At Wisconsin Whitewater. They don't have finals at any of the smaller schools that are playing playoffs and playing 15 weeks of football. Give me a freaking break. That's just ridiculous. But it is National Signing Day. Obviously, that's why we had Harbaugh and Herb at the close of the montage there. We will be talking about their respective classes. And the 4 o'clock hour, about 4:10, Andrew Lind, 11warriors.com. That's the Buckeye site. 4:35, Von Lozen at mazenbrew.com. That is a Wolverine site. And we're looking forward to talking to both of them about the classes that the coaches have reeled in. Michigan, of course, has some serious catching up to do. Also got some things to give away today. I do believe we have some hockey tickets to give away. Walleye tickets are going to be coming up if you want to go see the Walleye on Friday. And then I think we have more for Sunday. So we got a bunch of good stuff to give away, too. We'll tell you about that as the program goes on. Coming up at 3:35, we are going to talk about the train wreck that is the Cleveland Cavaliers. Dennis Maniloff, who will join us out of Cleveland. He covers and writes for a newspaper there and for Cleveland.com, will tell us about the first Cavaliers team ever. No, I'm sorry. First LeBron James team ever to lose by double digits after once having a 20-point lead in a game. They once led by 21 last night, lost by 18 for crying out loud. The Cavaliers cannot stop the bleeding. They scored 43 points in the first quarter. They scored 9 in the fourth quarter. They didn't do that against the defending champion, Golden State Warriors. They didn't do that against the red hot and top one of the top two teams in the West, Houston Rockets. They didn't do that against the leading Eastern Conference team, the Boston Celtics, they blew a 21-point lead and lost by 18. They scored 43 in the first and 9 in all 12 minutes of the fourth against the Orlando Magic. The Orlando Magic is the worst team in the Eastern Conference. All right, deadlock there with 17 wins apiece with the Atlanta Hawks. This is a train wreck. And the refusal for of the Cavaliers ownership and for GM Kobe Altman, who's really in over his head as far as I'm concerned, David Griffin's absence is rearing its ugly head now more than ever, to hold Ty Lue accountable for this is simply inexcusable. And oh, by the way, LeBron James shall be held accountable as well once again on this program, but I'm going to wait until 3:35 to talk about that with Maniloff. You really might want to strap yourself in. If you're going to be in the car at that time, make sure the seatbelt is pulled extra tight, because Maniloff and I are going to go. He is a LeBron James homer of the highest magnitude. And I say that with all due respect, because he acknowledges as much. He said he never is going to badmouth the king. He is just a big-time King fan, okay? And I love Dennis, and we've had many great agreements and disagreements on sports on this program and in our personal lives. Great, great conversations are to come. But we're going to fight, because he thinks the king can do no wrong, and I essentially think the king is very, very wrong right now. And we're going to have that brawl coming up at about 3:35. I'm just going to go ahead and characterize it as such, even though I hope it won't become that. It's just what I'm kind of predicting. Okay. Now, having said all that, what do I want to start with? I want to start with Josh McDaniels and the Indianapolis Colts. What an unbelievable situation. We all know that knew that after the Super Bowl, the Patriots were going to lose two coordinators. They were about to lose their defensive coordinator Matt Patricia to the Lions, their offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels to the Colts. Both sides have kind of already had their little verbal agreements, whatever you want to call them. And sure enough, Matt Patricia is being introduced today in Detroit. Indianapolis had planned to introduce Josh McDaniels as well, but at the very last second, Josh McDaniels, after yesterday morning, the Colts tweeting out that we have our new head coach, Josh McDaniels. He'll be introduced later. Josh McDaniels said, you know, I didn't sign my name on that contract yet. All we did was have a verbal. I'm not comfortable. I'm not liking it. I want to go back to New England. And here we go. He is on his way back, or he is already back in New England, and the Colts are bitter. The Colts are livid. Why wouldn't they be? Josh McDaniels essentially left them at the altar. It's like that bride who gets cold feet at the last second. Why would Josh McDaniels not be comfortable taking over the Indianapolis Colts, who, if he is healthy after missing this entire past season, have a franchise quarterback in the person of Andrew Luck? A lot of good picks because of a poor season. Why wouldn't he want to take over the Indianapolis Colts and resurrect his head coaching career, which, of course, started and ended in Denver with a very ignominious debut there? He went back to coordinator status, did phenomenally, and now he's getting that other opportunity. Why did he turn the job down? Golic and Wingo addressed this morning with Bill Polian, of course, who is famous for his work with the Colts franchise for many, many years. Give this a listen.
How this messes them up, doesn't mess them up, how now they have two coaches that are under contract that I believe have to be there with the next coach. How do they all work through all this stuff?
Well, they're going to work through it fine. I got off the plane at 10 o'clock last night and looked at my phone, and it had blown up.
I bet.
And it was all really, you know, people from the Colts family calling one another, going back to my days there. What the heck happened?
Yeah.
You know. So we quickly found out what had happened, that McDaniels had backed out. And they're fine with it. I talked to people in the organization. They're fine with it. They're moving on. They have a list of a short list of people they're going to talk to. They'll get a coach. They're going to absolutely honor the contracts of the coaches that McDaniel wanted them to hire,
right.
And they did. So they'll honor those contracts, and those players, those guys will be with them. So they'll just move on. You know, it's as simple as that. No one's upset. No one's crying about spilled milk. As one person said to me, who I highly respect, former teammate, better to learn it now than later.
Bill Polian trying to tell Golic and Wingo, and again, he was the vice president of the Colts for, I don't know, 15 years, somewhere in that neighborhood. He was, I think, 98 to around 2011 is when he was with the Colts franchise. He knows them very well. He says they are not upset. They are not angry. There's no crying about it, et cetera. They're fine. He's wrong, and he knows he's wrong. He's intentionally being misleading because he's trying to put the best face on this for his former friends, colleagues, and associates in Indianapolis. Clearly, they're angry, as was evidenced by their statement when they announced that McDaniels did indeed turn down the job, and they are now resuming their coaching search immediately. All of the coaches that they had talked to prior to deciding on McDaniels have already taken other jobs. All of them, or have decided they're staying in their current jobs, such as the Baylor coach. All of them. They now are starting a search all over again that they thought they had ended 22 days ago. Of course they're angry. Of course they're upset. It is very, very inappropriate and unprofessional for Josh McDaniels to do this, and the Colts have a right to be upset by this. Now, having said that, and just remember, you know, they interviewed Mike Vrabel. He was hired by the Titans. They interviewed Matt Nagy. He was hired by the Bears. Matt Rhule, the coach of Baylor, decided to stay at Baylor. They talked to a number of other individuals who have, you know, that were interesting to them, but they got McDaniels on a verbal, and so that's where it is. Now you say to yourself, what are they supposed to do? I don't know. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to sell to the fans that this is the guy that we want. After the guy that we really wanted spurned the job, and other guys that we wanted that we interviewed took other jobs, and we had to start all over again. This is the guy that we think will guide us into the future. This is going to be a PR nightmare for the Colts. So when Bill Polian tells Golic and Wingo that this is no big deal to them, they're not upset, this is okay, he's just trying to put the most positive, you know, face on this or spin on this as possible. Of course it bothers them, and it should. However, I think we also need to acknowledge the fact, and he said it at the end of his commentary that you just heard that we played for him, it is a good thing to find it out now rather than later. What would they rather have had? Josh McDaniels, who, quite frankly, according to multiple reports, didn't just trip over this idea to not go, you know, yesterday. And everybody's saying, well, you know, the Patriots sweetened his deal. And they did. They gave him more money. They overpaid to keep him there as the offensive coordinator and probably have plans on him being the heir apparent to Bill Belichick, right? So some say, well, the Patriots just stepped in at the last second and bought him off, bought him away from the Indianapolis Colts. But that's not the whole story, because multiple sources close to McDaniels have said he wasn't sure the first time he interviewed with the Colts for the job, and was told verbally that he could have it. He wanted a second meeting with them, and he had a second meeting with them. And he still walked away, okay, I'm going to do this, but was very apprehensive, in large part, according to those sources, simply, you know, people don't understand this, in coaching and in radio. You might say, well, how are you going to compare yourself to a coach? I'm just telling you, this is the nature of the two businesses, the two industries, okay? In coaching and in radio, you pretty much have to be mobile. It's hard on a family. It just is. I reference this from time to time when I try to tell people about the industry that I'm in and that we are in. The old WKRP in Cincinnati TV show from the late 1970s, and maybe it was in the early 1980s, I don't remember. But remember WKRP in Cincinnati with Dr. Johnny Fever and Venus Flytrap and Les Nessman? Remember the song? Got kind of tired of traveling and unpacking town to town and up and down the dial. It's true. You move around a lot in radio. Companies change, time slots change, budgets change. You got to move to your next job. This is just the way that it is. Well, obviously it's that way in coaching. And Josh McDaniels has a family. He's got kids that he's raising in New England who are comfortable in their schools. I don't know exactly where he lives in the New England area, but who are comfortable in their schools, and he just wasn't comfortable ripping his family up and moving to Indianapolis right now. And that is his right. So what would the Colts have rather done? Forced him to honor his verbal contract by signing a written contract, which, by the way, then becomes guaranteed, and then coach half-heartedly because he really isn't into it? That's like asking a girl out and having her turn you down the first three or four times, and finally, will you please go out with me? all right, if it'll shut you up, I'll go out with you. Do you really want to take that date? Do you want to buy a steak and lobster dinner for her if you know she's really not that into you? She's just going because she's tired of being asked? Same thing here. Do you want a coach who's really, all right, I told you I would sign and I'll come, but in his heart he's not there? He did them a favor by telling them no now. And rather than coaching half-heartedly, losing for a couple of seasons, and then getting fired, and they have to pay him a ton of money on his guaranteed contract. And then the last thing I'll say about this before we get to our bottom of the hour sports center and our wild stat is that this isn't a whole hell of a lot terribly different, is it, than everything else that is going on today? National Signing Day? How many kids planned to sign with one school today and then got a coach on the other line from the other school telling him, all right, I guarantee you'll start as a freshman. I guarantee you'll start somewhere. Throwing one last little, you know, whatever it is, perk that they could throw at them legally, and then suddenly the kid takes off the hat they were going to put on or puts it away and puts on another hat and flips. Sorry, coach, changed my mind. Going to the other school. Sorry, Urban, going to play for Saban. Sorry, Jimbo Fisher, going to play for Harbaugh. Whatever. You understand the point. That's all McDaniels just did. He's sorry. He took the cap off of the Colts. Sorry, guys, I'm going to stay and play up here for New England. It's very, very similar to what's going on there as well. All right. A lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of stuff to get into, including our bottom of the hour sports center, then talking Cavaliers with Maniloff, and more on signing day. Coming up in the second hour of the program. But for now, let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day. Brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Yesterday's Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day was talking about wire-to-wire losses. Well, happened again. But this time with the Thunder and the Warriors? That's right. Western Conference Showdown. Thunder beat the Warriors in Golden State 125-105. First time the Warriors have not led for a single minute in a home game since April of 2012. Holy cow, that's almost 5 years. That is indeed a wild stat. Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Sports Center coming up. Maniloff after that. Want to get you into the program as much as we can, but we are guest heavy today. Stay right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
To the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Listen, I'm here for the long haul. You know, I'm here for this season right now to try to, you know, figure out ways we can still compete. I couldn't give up on my teammates like that. I just couldn't do it. We put too much into the game. No matter how it ends up, I would never waive my no trade clause.
Oh, the king. You gotta love the king. I'm in it for the long haul. For the rest of this season. And I couldn't give up on my teammates until I leave at the end of this season. I would never give up my no trade clause because I want to choose where I leave at the end of this season. Oh, my goodness. And people wonder why. There is dysfunction in the Cleveland Cavaliers organization. They scored 43 points in the first quarter last night against the worst team in the Eastern Conference. They scored 9. In the fourth quarter of the very same game against the very same worst team. And the beatings go on. Joining us now from Cleveland to talk about King James, the Cavaliers, the train wreck of a season that nobody saw coming is Dennis Maniloff, who writes for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and for Cleveland.com. D-Man, good to talk to you again, my brother. How are you?
Bob France, always a pleasure. What's up?
Well, let me just lay it out like this. Brian Windhorst, a man you know very, very well, who knows LeBron James very, very well, who has chronicled his career from high school through Cleveland Part 1, through the Heat Check that he wrote for part of ESPN in Miami, and then back to Cleveland Part 2, says this.
His play and his focus and his effort level is eroding to levels I've never seen before. He's been guilty of pouting in the past. One of the examples I can give is when his first year back in Cleveland, when he was frustrated with Coach David Blatt and he was frustrated with some of his teammates, he ended up going to Miami while he was on injury treatment. But he was injured then. Right now, he's healthy.
That's a load of crap, by the way. He was not injured. That was the excuse to take time away because he was in pout mode.
And that doesn't explain why he is not giving his maximum effort. And I really do think it's a lot about the future as well as the present.
Dennis Mandeloff, LeBron James says he would never waive his no-trade clause because he's in it for the long haul. And by long haul, he means about 2 months. Go.
Well, listen, you know me. I'm a LeBron guy. But I am not going to sit here and tell you or your audience that he's without flaws. I mean, I have cracked him over the years for the passive-aggressive. That's probably his biggest flaw, or the personality trait that annoys us the most is, you know, one minute he's upset, and then the next minute he's not. The next minute it's somebody else's fault. The next minute it's his fault. So I'm not saying LeBron is without fault, but you know where I stand on this, and that is Dan Gilbert is most responsible for this situation, and it started with the decline, the fall, whatever you want to call it, of the Cavaliers, started with Dan Gilbert's failure to retain David Griffin as the general manager of the Cavs over money. Yes, and that's all it was. It wasn't like he had to do anything else. He had to pay him. Now, easy to spend other people's money, easy to spend other owners' money. But the bottom line is, when LeBron agreed to come back, he was under the impression that Gilbert would pay every last dollar for every member, every personnel person that he wanted. And in LeBron's mind, Griffin needed to stay. And as a result, LeBron's upset about that, and he's been grinding about it. And I'm not saying that he shouldn't get over it to a degree, but it certainly looks to me like he's thinking, if Griffin's here, I probably have Paul George. Now, that might not be true. Maybe that deal would have fallen apart even if Griffin had been the general manager. But in LeBron's mind, I'm guessing, I don't have a source, nobody has a source inside of his head, but I'm guessing LeBron's saying, if Griffin stays, if Gilbert pays Griffin like he's supposed to, I'm running with Paul George and probably Kyrie Irving, because Griffin would talk Irving down from his demand, and it would be Irving and me and George. And instead, I've got a broken down Kevin Love and a 5'9" guy that I can't stand. So I think that is the source of the discontent.
Okay.
For LeBron.
Let me come back with this. You're not incorrect. Dan Gilbert should have, and I said it at the same time as you did when it happened, there was no reason to not pay David Griffin and retain him. And you know, clearly he does not value the general manager position. He is just, you know, each time he's had a decent general manager, they average, 2 years? Because he's just going to let him go and get somebody else. Anybody else can negotiate contracts. You know, he's the one who's kind of running the show. I totally agree. Big mistake letting David Griffin go. Do not know if you would have gotten Paul George, as you pointed out. Do not know if that would have been the case. Do not know if he would have been able to talk Kyrie out of leaving when Kyrie already was tired of being sunned by LeBron James. What if he becomes option number three on a team, in which he's option number two falls behind Paul George in the pecking order? Don't know for sure if Kyrie would have left. But despite, let's assume for 1 second, Dennis, for the sake of discussion, that you're right on all of it, even though we can't be sure. Let's assume that you are right, and all those things could have and would have happened. They didn't. Does that give the king a pass to be a pouting, unmotivated, non-defense playing, non-leader of a locker room that still has the talent, despite its flaws, to at the very least win the Eastern Conference before you go and get smacked by the winner of the West? Does it allow him? I mean, you know the old adage, Dennis, speed of the leader, it works in business and it works in sports, speed of the pack. If LeBron James is unmotivated and moping, what does the rest of the roster do? It's unmotivated and it mopes. And I feel like if he would just stop pouting and stop babying himself and stop crying about the fact that he didn't get all of the things you just pointed out that he wanted and played his you-know-whats off, everybody else would be motivated to do that too, and you won't be giving up a 21-point lead to the Orlando Magic and then losing by 18 in one of the most embarrassing games in LeBron James' career.
Those are fair points. All of them, Bob. And again, I go back to what I said, that LeBron is not above reproach, as good as he is. You know, he hasn't played well and lately, and he's been part of the problem. I happen to believe that more of it is just the fact that he's physically worn down than it is pouting, but I do see where people can draw that inference. Or they can think, okay, he's pouting out there, or he's sulking. I get it. I can see where people can come to that thought process.
Do you disagree with Wendy on that clip? Just the last part of it here.
And that doesn't explain why he is not giving his maximum effort. And I really do think it's a lot about the future as well as the present.
Is he not giving his maximum effort because he knows he is already gone? He has no reason to remain invested in this team, despite his words yesterday about, I'm not going to give up on my guys and throw shade on our season when we still have a lot to go. Wendy is watching, and I think Wendy knows him probably better than anybody else in the entire media nationally. Or internationally, for that matter, given the global star that he is. But do you disagree with Wendy when he said he's not giving his effort because he's thinking about the future, and the future is not in Cleveland?
I'm going to respectfully disagree with Wendy. I disagreed with him when he said LeBron wouldn't leave Cleveland the first time. I proved to be correct. I disagreed with him when he said LeBron wouldn't come back. I proved to be correct. So I'm going to disagree with him here. I believe I have credibility where LeBron is concerned because I've studied him like crazy. It's as if I've taken a course in LeBron. So I've watched him since day one. I did miss a few of his games while he was with the Heat. I grant you that. But here's what I'm thinking. If you want me on here to give you my expertise, I'll give you my expertise. Here's what I believe is going through LeBron's head. As I said, LeBron is upset. Yes. He's sulking. Yes. Is it automatically adversely affecting his play? Probably to a degree. But I think the overriding thing is not that he's checked out and I know I'm out of here after this year. What he's saying is, I could have been running with Paul George. And think about last night. He finishes that collapse against the Magic. Presumably they fly home after the game. I'm not sure. Or in any case, he's watching probably Oak City at Golden State, and he's watching Oak City run over Golden State with Paul George and Westbrook doing their thing. LeBron's saying that could have been us. It could have been me and George and probably Kyrie if Dan Gilbert had held up his end of the deal and spent every last dollar on all personnel.
Yeah, but we covered all that. But, Dennis, we covered all that. And my response is, what is he, 7, 8 maybe? I didn't get what I wanted from mom or dad. Therefore, I'm going to not do what I have to do. I'm not going to do my chores. I'm not going to do my schoolwork. He's a grown A man in the maybe on the decline now, the beginning of the decline toward the end of his career, where you know, every season matters. And can he afford to play 7-year-old kid pouting because he didn't get what toys he wanted for Christmas?
Right. And I know we had covered it. What I was trying to say was, Wendy says the pouting's coming from, I'm checking out after this year. I'm saying it's coming from, I didn't have enough groceries this year to work with. And, oh, by the way, in his mind, they gave Kyrie away for free. Okay, because what the Cavs got for Kyrie is nothing.
You're right.
And you talk about the draft pick all you want, but as far as LeBron's concerned, that's nobody. You know, so they got fleeced in the Kyrie trade. Love is injured and not all that reliable, even when, you know, over the course of a season, because he always seems to get hurt somewhere. So LeBron is looking around at his team that he wants to win this year, and he's saying, I don't have enough. I don't have enough. So I don't think he's checked out, like, I can't wait for free agency. I think he's saying, I don't have enough to win, and it's depressing. Now, does it excuse it? No, you're right. It doesn't excuse that. It's not, he should be a professional, 100% effort every night. But you know what? If I were LeBron James and I had that little guy next to me jacking up shots, playing horrible, and then criticizing my team when he's one of the main reasons we stink, I'd be annoyed too if I'm out on the court with him. So, you know, there's those things in play, but I think it's more frustration about this year than it is I'm resigned to leaving after this year.
We're talking to Dennis Baniloff, who covers the Cavaliers and more for Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I said this yesterday, and just get your reaction. Last thing on LeBron, then we'll talk about the trade deadline. You know, when you're chasing the GOAT, or in his words, the ghost, the way that he is, I don't believe that you can afford to play and to carry and comport yourself in a way that would have a reporter say this about
you. And that
you.
Doesn't explain why he is not giving his maximum effort, and I really do think...
I don't know that I ever can imagine in a million years, we didn't have the internet back when Jordan was playing, the GOAT, or when Magic, or when Bird, or any of the other greats were playing, but I cannot imagine ever hearing a reporter say he's not giving his maximum effort. They always gave their maximum effort. Always the greatest of all time. If he wants that Mount Rushmore status, or if he actually wants to be, you know, to replace Michael as the GOAT, again, from a legacy standpoint, let's talk about current, present time, and, you know, the future of LeBron James' legacy. I mean, is this how you want to carry yourself? Is this how you want to comport yourself? He pouted for two weeks during the David Blatt first year, as Wendy pointed out, went down to Miami and got back treatment, which was a Chase lounge on the beach with a Mai Tai. That's his back treatment for his injury. And now he's pouting here and giving a terrible effort. Can a guy who wants to be the all-time greatest, I'll ask you, I mean, did you ever hear, you're about my age, did you ever hear anybody saying any of those things about the real GOATs of this sport?
I don't remember them, Bob, and, you know, it's quite possible that it wasn't ever said about Michael Jordan that he checked out like this. I think you just have different people. Different people have different personalities. LeBron has a passive-aggressive personality. That's just who he is.
Yeah.
He's not going to change that element of him. He also has a personality or a character trait that will pout and will sulk. I think when you talk about the all-time greats, he knows that people, that a certain segment of the population that cares about such things will always put Michael Jordan first, regardless of what LeBron does, because of the 6-0, the perfect record in the finals.
Right.
So LeBron's saying, okay, I'm going to go out, you know, finish the career on my own terms. I'm chasing the ghost, but I realize even if I do think that what I've done is enough to be unquestionably number one, it's never going to be enough. But I don't mind being listed among the all-time greats as one of the top five, if you will. And he probably figures, okay, no matter what I do from here on out, I will be listed among the all-time greats, so I'm not going to worry about somebody criticizing me about sulking or complaining or anything. So that's how I think he views his legacy.
Let's talk about Tyronn Lue, and this actually ties to LeBron in some ways because people, many, myself included, believe he got David Blatt fired, and his, you know, ignoring of Blatt during huddles and timeouts during that first year and into that second year. While Blatt talked to the rest of the team, he would sit over and talk privately with Lue, made it very clear that that's who he liked. I think he got David Blatt fired and Tyronn Lue hired. Is that the reason why Dan Gilbert has said, and Kobe Altman have said, Ty Lue is safe? No, we are not considering firing him despite this epic collapse that we have seen since the first of the year.
It's fascinating what you just brought up, Bob, because you're right. I mean, how soon we forget, you didn't, obviously, I did, that when Blatt was fired, in the run-up to Blatt, it certainly appeared as though Ty Lue, the former player, was undercutting Blatt. Even if it was subtle, even if it was not so subtle, he was undercutting him. And the players seemed to love Ty Lue and detest Blatt. And how quickly things have changed. I'm not saying they detest Ty Lue, but
no, I get it.
I don't sense any love for the guy. I don't sense any, like, you know, we're going to rally around Ty Lue, and Ty Lue, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. I don't sense that, you know, with him. So I don't know if LeBron is tired of them already or you know what. I'm not saying it's an easy team to coach. You know, Lou fired that shot a few weeks ago about agendas. You know, it's a bunch of egos. It's an ill-conceived team. It's a bunch of individuals that are thrown together with the same uniform. They don't really have any chemistry at either end of the court. But having said that, though, I'm going to take you back to the stretch when they won 18 of 19. Yes, they fattened up against bad teams, but during that stretch, they were going to beat a team like the Magic with no issues, all right, as opposed to now. I think, and you were going to get into the trade deadline, but one of the reasons they were going well was their point guard situation. And Jose Calderon was in the middle of that when they were actually running some semblance of an offense when Calderon was the point guard.
Absolutely
right.
And
as soon as Isaiah came back, that all went to the crapper, and it was every man for himself and a five one-on-ones on the offensive end.
So is it not then up to the head coach? I mean, two things, actually, following up on this. Number one, Lou has to be the one to rally all of these personalities that you're talking about together. You know, I mean, it's kind of his job. I cannot imagine a coach being less effective at trying to stop the bleeding the way this team is bleeding, especially last night, given the way things went. You score 43 in the first, you give up 41 in the third, then you score 9 in the fourth. A coach has to do something in the middle of this. And then second of all, why doesn't Ty Lue grow the you-know-whats, the grapefruits, to say, you know what, IT, it isn't working. It was working when Jose was running the point and we won 19 in a row. Jose is getting what? What's Calderon getting? 2-3 minutes a night max? Get him back onto the floor. Can't Ty Lue do that?
Well, therein lies the rub. First of all, Lou gets a pass for last night specifically because he did leave because of illness. He was not coaching the team by the end of the game. He was out of there, I think, by halftime. In the first half.
No, I get it. I was using last night as just the example of the way they are now.
I know.
But go ahead.
I know you were. I just want to let people know that T. Lou was under the weather yesterday. But the overarching point makes sense. Here's the key.
Hey, real quick. Real quick, did Isaiah Thomas hold a meeting and question whether or not Lou was really sick?
That was on Twitter. It was a fantastic tweet. Lou didn't get permission from Thomas to be sick. Here's the key, though. I am afraid, this is, again, my gut, I'm afraid that because Dan Gilbert reportedly loves Isaiah Thomas, the Ken Berger article about how Gilbert has formed a bond with Isaiah Thomas, my belief is that Ty Lue is playing Isaiah Thomas because Dan Gilbert either tells him directly or the implication is you better play him or else. And that is hurting this team. And that's why I've advocated for the trade of Isaiah Thomas because I'll tell you this. The Cavs have about a 1% chance of getting out of the East the way I see it.
Yeah.
They have a 0% chance if Isaiah Thomas is on this roster past the trade deadline tomorrow. But my fear, again, is that Gilbert's calling the shots. He's the de facto GM, and he does not – he wants to build around Isaiah Thomas in the post-LeBron era. So I'm afraid that Isaiah Thomas will not be traded. I hope I'm wrong.
I do, too, and I'm glad you got to that because that was going to be my question. By the way, I can understand why Gilbert has an affinity for IT because I think they're about the same height. All right, good stuff, Dennis Maniloff, as always.
I didn't want to be accused of heightism.
Dennis Maniloff, great analysis, as always. I appreciate the back-and-forth tug-of-war, mano a mano, whatever you want to call it, on LeBron. You're always going to be the Kings, one of all of the Kings' men, and I am going to be one of those ones trying to knock him down again. I'll talk to you next time, my man.
See you, bud.
You got it. There's Dennis Maniloff. Let's get a timeout for the top of the hour local sports center. We come back. We got the Big 4 at 4 coming up, and then signing day 2018. How did the Buckeyes do? How did the Wolverines do? We've got guests from both camps, and that's coming up in hour number 2 right here on the Ticket.
I mean, it's just a combination of our season, you know, pretty much. You know, we've had big leads this year, and we've lost them. for whatever reason. They came out with a lot of such urgency. They drove our closeouts, you know, hit some big-time shots in the third quarter, and Simmons was really good in the third, obviously. So, you know, I just couldn't stop it once the snowball kind of turned into an avalanche in the third, and 41-point quarter is hard to come back from. It's been tough because we had, you know, a few guys that's been struggling as of late, and you want to try to pick them up and not lose your, you know, your own individual ability to help the team. You know, it's no time to, you know, to throw shade about our season. We got to continue to be positive and continue to push forward. We got quite a few games left, and, you know, still serious about the season, and we got to, you know, now play some good ball, you know, at some point. Listen, I'm here for the long haul. You know, I'm here for this season right now to try to, you know, figure out ways we can still compete. And I couldn't give up on my teammates like that. I just couldn't do it. We put too much into the game, you know, every single day. We go out and prepare, even though win, lose, or draw. At the end of the day, we are brothers, and we understand that. And I owe it to my teammates to finish the season out. No matter how it ends up, I would never wave my no-trade clause.
They're a bad basketball team.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, they really are a bad basketball team. Tonight, it really stood out to me because they got to score about 40 points in a 28-minute stretch. To a team that didn't have Aaron Gordon or Vucevic. First thing they don't do that other teams do in this league that are relevant, they don't fight through any adversity. I think what it really comes down to is when they hit a bad stretch in the game where they go five or six possessions and they don't score, their body language collectively shows no resolve whatsoever to start fighting back. And instead, they just splinter and fracture, and it turns into what you saw tonight. So that is a real problem for a team that's supposed to be able to contend.
I like a lot of things. Football players, good students. But I think the thing I like best is there's guys that really wanted to be at Michigan. Appreciate, you know, what Michigan has to offer, the football powerhouse and an academic powerhouse. I like the production in football games, guys that are record setters and they're state champions. If I was Shea Patterson, I would have the mindset of, well, where did they get a load of me? All three have the license and ability to be great.
We just signed 26 players with a very highly ranked class, a class that I think it follows suit the last two that we've brought in here as far as academic fit for Ohio State University, a culture fit, and a character fit. People ask the question, did you like the early signing period? We did very well. The majority of class was signed on that date. But it all worked out. January was far less drama, far less panic like you normally speak or normally you deal with in January. So I'm going to be curious to see how our colleagues feel about it.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed, rolling right along. Well, kind of rolling right along. We kind of ground to a halt there for just a minute. Boy, that was a long break. Apologies for that. We have a lot of stuff still to get to. We're going to talk about the last thing you heard in the montage. Urban Meyer, Jim Harbaugh, in that order, rather than the order you just heard. We're going to talk with both camps, so to speak, in just a couple. We're going to talk with 11warriors.com, which is a Buckeye site about their recruiting class on this National Signing Day. Von Lozen of MazeandBrew.com will talk about the Wolverines recruiting class on the other side of that. But before we do any of that, it's time for the Big Four.
And now, the Big Four at Four on the Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Today's Big Four at Four, subject extraordinaire, the four least likeliest Super Bowl winning quarterbacks ever. This, of course, was spurred by Sunday's Nick Foles victory for the Philadelphia Eagles over Tom Brady, the least likeliest quarterback winners of Super Bowls. Number one in the Big Four at Four, Jeff Hostetler. Super Bowl 25, you may or may not recall, Jeff Hostetler. Filled in for Phil Sims, who broke his foot a few weeks before the playoffs, forcing Hostetler to guide the Giants. And in what I think is a shocking win, it was the wide right game. That was the one in which the Bills should have won their one and only Super Bowl championship in their four straight losses. Hostetler was 20 of 32 for 222 and one touchdown, the unlikely winner there. Super Bowl 26, 1 year later, Mark Rippon, who ended up as the game's MVP, going 18 of 33. That's not great. But 292 yards, a couple of touchdowns against, again, the Buffalo Bills. Mark Rippon was essentially a career backup. He won and was the unlikely Super Bowl winning quarterback. Super Bowl number 35 is where we find number three of the Big Four at Four, Trent Dilfer, of course. One of the great defenses of all time and a great running game sparked by Jamal Lewis carried Trent Dilfer, who threw for just 153 yards and one touchdown for the Ravens in their Super Bowl win over the Giants, Super Bowl 35. And are you ready for this one? This one might strike you a little bit. Ready? Super Bowl number three, Joe Namath, unlikely, one of the four unlikely Super Bowl winning quarterbacks. Why, you may ask? Simple. The Jets were 17-point underdogs. 17-point underdogs to the Baltimore Colts. Remember, the Jets were the AFL champs. The Baltimore Colts were the NFL champs. And Broadway Joe guaranteeing that win, what made it stand out is the fact that he guaranteed a win over a team that was 17-point favorites over them. That makes him very unlikely to actually win that Super Bowl. Namath didn't do a ton in the game. He completed 17 out of 28 for just 206 yards. But he did lead his team to a 16-7 very unlikely win over the NFL champion Colts. There you go. Joe Namath, your fourth of the big four at four on this Wednesday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza. All right, there you go. Big four at four. We'll do that each and every day at 4 o'clock or closely thereafter. It is 4:19 now, and we are trying to hook up with our guest from 11warriors.com to talk a little bit about the Ohio State recruiting class on this National Signing Day. And what's weird about this, Kush, I don't know about you, I am less into this signing day than I have been in previous years because it is the second of two signing days. And a lot of the questions were answered about 2 months ago when they had the first signing day back in, I guess it was mid-December. Was
yeah, around
not?
December 20th.
Yeah. The fact that they had the early signing period, which is the first time they've done this, makes this one a little bit less compelling and intriguing, unless I'm wrong. What do you think?
No, no, it has an anticlimactic feel to it because we got a lot of these names, especially for the big boys. We got a lot of these names and players already. We got them in December. Now, there are a few that obviously didn't, like the big one that Ohio State snagged earlier today. And then another one that they, another four-star guy they just nabbed today. But most of the other guys, you know, they were already in as of December. In fact, I'm looking at the Ohio State list, for example, right now. And only one, two, three, four, five, only five guys, a five-star, three, four-star, and a three-star guy. At least that's according to Rivals.com. You know, you go to sure. whatever site, it might sure. be different. All those five guys are the only ones that have committed to the Buckeyes, for example. After the December 20th early signing day. So to me, it's had an anticlimactic feel to it.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I kind of agree a little bit because, you know, so many of those major play, you know, we even played some of the cuts from, I want to say, Nick Saban back on the December 20th day and Urban Meyer. And they talked about how much they kind of didn't like this. You know, it's, you know, at the time, or Nick Saban is preparing for the national championship game when they're trying to do their recruiting and get guys to sign early. And then there's the question of whether or not you promise guys immediately if, you know, we're going to sign you on the second signing day. We're not ready to give you that letter of intent right now for you to fax to us, or vice versa. We want you to fax this to us right now on this first signing day. If you try to wait, we can't guarantee that we're still going to hold your scholarship. And it puts a lot of chaos into play here. The kids don't know. The players don't know how bad they're wanted. If you wait to get that offer for the second signing day, does that mean they don't want you as much as the guys that they signed on the first signing day? And conversely, if you don't get a kid's name on the dotted line in the first one, do you run the risk of them being flipped by another coach before today, the, you know, what would be the quote-unquote official or the traditionally official National Signing Day, Kush?
And we'll hear more about an example of that, I think, coming up at the bottom of the hour when we talk with our Michigan guy, because that happened to them earlier today as well. The four-star linebacker who way back in 2016 had quote-unquote committed to Michigan, well, he changed that today and he's going to Georgia.
Sorry.
So that's
that.
Just one that's the one example of that last part you're talking about.
Yeah, that is exactly what I'm talking about. So just because we're not sure if we're going to get our guest, we are scheduled to talk with 11warriors.com about the Buckeyes National Signing Day signings today. Andrew Lind is scheduled to join us. If he doesn't get to us, we'll kind of just give you a rundown of what we know already. And then at 4:35, 4:40, we'll go to the Michigan side of things. Von Lozen of MazeandBrew.com. I know he's going to be on because he's already tweeted about it to us. On our Twitter feed. Jalen Gill, Westerville South, who is a back. He is 6'1", 185, and I don't have the star ratings next to each of these guys, Jim, so feel free to add anything you want to about these guys. You mentioned one of the biggest signings of the day, Nick Pettit-Freer, 6'6", 272-pounder out of Tampa, committing to the Buckeyes. Taron Vincent, defensive tackle, 6'3", 290, out of the IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida. Cameron Babb, Christian Brothers School out of St. Louis, is a wide receiver at 6'1", 189. Cameron Brown of from the same school, 6'1", 175, another wide receiver. I never said, boy, I wonder if they won the state championship. You got that kind of talent of receiver. And then Tommy Togai, or Togai, I'm going to guess, and that's out of Highland. Pocatello, Idaho. How many times did you see a Buckeye?
Look at that. The Urban Meyer claws going to the Rocky Mountains. Love it.
How about that? Buckeye signed a guy out of Idaho, potato country, 6'4", 306-pound defensive tackle. And, Kush, I don't know if you have any more on those guys that you want to hit as far as stars go. But, you know, that's why it seems anticlimactic, because we're talking about 2, 4, 6 guys, whereas normally we'd be talking about 15, 18, 20 guys in a given day on national signing day.
And Tommy's the type of guy who I can't remember when we did have Andrew on back in December. He may have been brought up then at the early signing day, because this is on Rivals' site I'm looking at right now. His commitment date was December 12th, so before the December 20th-ish early signing day. So he's already been in tow. This is not a new thing.
Kush, I've talked in the past about the ceremonies that are held for these kids. You know, you know, they turn them into circuses, and they turn these guys into diva superstars at a very young age, you know, and then you wonder why they feel like they're entitled when they get to college to take free stuff. These shows, you know, we're going to put all the caps on the table, or we're going to have somebody's going to reach into a sweat bag and pull out the right sweatshirt or whatever to make their announcement. And all these coaches, of course, who have been kissing their rear ends for the last, you know, 12 to 18 to maybe even longer, you know, months, to try to get them to come, are all waiting on pins and needles to see whether or not he picks us. My God, I don't know why nobody's ever made this comparison before, or maybe they did. It's repeated in high school gymnasiums all over the country for superstar high school players. It's LeBron. It's the decision. It's the decision on national TV, and in these cases, many of them are on national TV. They carry these signings of the top five-star guy, the guy, you know, top five guys in the ESPN 300, or, you know, the five-star guys from Rivals, whatever it is. They do carry these live on TV, sometimes nationally, sometimes local TV, certainly on at least social media live, Facebook live. They're all a bunch of mini LeBron James decisions.
Yeah, that predates the decision.
In front of Jim, what's that?
That predate the decision, because let's not mistake, this has been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, of course it has. It's just that since LeBron did that in 2010, it's just a great comparison to me. And because we all mock LeBron for that, and we all mocked ESPN, rightfully so, I think, for giving him the platform to sit there and go, you know, after much contemplation and thoughts with my family, I've decided to enter the University of so-and-so. It was LeBron James saying to take my talents to South Beach. And we mocked it because of how cheesy and contrived it was. We mocked it for how, you know, he didn't even bother telling Dan Gilbert that he was leaving before Dan Gilbert saw it on television like everybody else. And then immediately grabbed his computer and started Comic Sans fonting his way into history. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And these kids do exactly the same thing. You know, they don't tell the coach of the school that they're going to, and they don't tell the coach of the schools that they are turning down despite all of their efforts for the last, as I say, 12, 18, 24 months, however long some of these guys have been recruited. You know, and that's a problem for me anyway. They feed these guys. They honor these guys. They turn them into, like I said, diva, you know, superstars, and quite frankly, into clowns in some cases. Well, it's because of that that I bring you this story. This was one of those moments, right?
Okay.
Jason Copeland, who is a, what is he? He is a, you know what? It's funny. The story didn't even tell me what position he plays. And I don't care, really, because it's what he did. Although it would kind of help, I think, a little bit just to know a little bit more about him. But anyway, he is a recruit that is, boy, what a terrible story from the Sporting News to not have what high school he came from or what position he plays or how many stars he had or anything else. What a terrible job by the Sporting News, which is where I found this story. But here it is anyway. Jason Copeland had three hats on the table in one of these LeBron decision moments, right?
Mm-hmm.
In front of him as he prepared to make his announcement on National Signing Day. Tennessee, Alabama, and Florida caps were in front of him. His mom, seated next to him, was wearing a Tennessee hat and an Alabama sweater or sweatshirt. A member of his crew, his friends, his team, his family, whatever, also wore Tennessee gear standing behind him. So when he picked up the Florida hat, mom stopped and stormed away. Mom left the gym on TV, on national television. ESPN was carrying this, and the ESPN host immediately asked Copeland about what had happened. He said, "I don't know exactly why she walked out. I can't go with my mom. I want to go with my heart." His heart told him Florida. ESPN2 later reported Copeland's mother returned to the gym where her son had committed to his college future after the fact. But she's got on an Alabama sweatshirt and a Tennessee hat, and the son picks up Florida, the third of the three. And mom got so upset, she just walked out. I find that just this side of hilarious.
That is a pretty funny story, no doubt about it. But
now my question is, who the hell is Jason Copeland, and why is this such a poorly written story by a reputable sports site? This didn't come from, you know, some blog from somebody's basement. It's the Sporting News, and all they're telling us is Jason Copeland. How about SB Nation? SB Nation tells me it's four-star wide receiver. There we go. Four-star wide receiver Jason Copeland's mom.
Humorously, I have the ESPN on my part of the studio here on in the background, and they were just showing that, literally just showing that. So I just saw the mom walking out and everything.
I'm surprised. You know, I'm just picturing a mom moment, you know, where she gives him the back of the hand.
I was waiting for
smack in the
up.
Back of the hand. Junior, what the hell are you doing? You're not going to Florida. You're going to one of these two places. He's got her Bama and her Tennessee representing. Oh, that is just all kind of funny. You know what? I don't know how it worked out, obviously, and I have no idea what kind of a player he is, but it's just underscores what I mean. Dan Gilbert was Jason Copeland's mom, and Jason Copeland was LeBron James. This was LeBron saying, "I'm going to take my talents to South Beach," and Dan Gilbert going, "What?" This was Jason Copeland saying, "I'm going to take my talents to South Beach," sort of, kind of, Gainesville, close enough, same state, leave me alone, get off me. And it was Dan Gilbert, Jason Copeland's mom, "What? I'm out of here." And she stormed away mad. So, I mean, really, that's what makes the signing day so interesting, at least in my opinion. What makes it so interesting is that it's we treat these guys like divas and stage performances for them that we panned, that we mocked, that we criticized when LeBron James did it for his free agency future. I find that all kind of funny.
Now,
I have no idea if this audio is going to be anything to hear at all, but I'm going to play it just to see what happens the moment he picked up the Florida cap.
His mother walked off after the announcement. She did come back and get him out. Okay. And a lot of tears, a lot of emotions over Jacob Copeland.
That's the football scoop staff posting that video from ESPN. I just wanted to see. But, there she is. There she is. Nice to see the video. Did you see the video of mom coming back?
No, they didn't show that one. It's just so funny. In the background.
This hug right now is just so funny. I mean, he's got a red jacket on, which looks all kind of crimson, which would make him, what, Crimson Tide?
Right.
He's got a red jacket and a red a bow tie on. He looks like he's all ready to go Bama. Mom is wearing the same colored red sweatshirt. It's all about Bama. But she's got the orange and white checkered hat like the end zones wear in Knoxville at Tennessee. She's got the Tennessee hat, the Bama jacket. He's got the Bama sweatshirt. He's got the Bama jacket on, and then he puts on the blue Florida Gators cap. She stormed away, but she eventually did come back and hug her son. So that's good. She's not kicking him out of the house. I suppose that's probably a good thing. And as a four-star recruit, you probably don't want to kick him out of the house because in about 4 years, you're going to be asking him to build you one. All right.
Swing this back around, though, real quick, since we weren't able to hook up with Andrew Lynn, the moral of the story for the Ohio State side of things is they get the big guy today in the offensive lineman from Florida at the last minute. And according to most sites, whether it's Rivals or the rest, they're saying Ohio State number two in all the land behind not Alabama, but Georgia.
Yeah, Georgia has been ranked number one since the December 20 signing period.
Indeed.
You know, and at that time, Jim, a lot of consternation up in Ann Arbor because people are saying the Wolverines aren't being given credit for a top five class. The Wolverines at that point in time were said to have had something of a disappointing run here at recruiting in this Jim Harbaugh's, going into Jim Harbaugh's fourth year. Did that change today? Where are they ranked nationally after all the haul, if you will? We're going to talk about that. Hopefully we'll get our guest this time around, Von Lozen from maizeandbrew.com, to talk about that from the Wolverine side of things. Hey, but on the way into the bottom of the hour, Sports Center, I told you about hockey tickets. Indeed, I did not lie. I've got three pair of tickets for hockey. Yeah, that would be hockey tickets, hickets. I got three pair of hickets for the Walleye and Kansas City Mavericks on Friday at Huntington Center. 7:15, the puck drops, and I'll give all three pairs away right now. Callers 4, 5, and 6. Callers 4, 5, and 6 right now. You'll each get a pair of tickets if you want to go see the Mavericks take on your Walleye at Huntington Center on Friday. So we'll do that now. We'll get our bottom of the hour local sports center. Then we'll come back and talk about National Signing Day from the Wolverines' perspective. Did they do any better this time around? That's coming up next right here on the All right, 4:42 as we roll right along here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. Hope you're having a good Wednesday. Drive Time coming your way in about 18 minutes plus, top of the hour sports center coverage. Want to go right back to National Signing Day. We did not get a chance to talk to 11warriors.com, but we do have Maize and Brew on the line. What is Maize and Brew? You know Maize and Brew. One of the best Michigan fan sites going. And joining us now to talk about the Wolverine signing class on signing day, or recruiting class, I should say, on signing day, is Von Lozen from maizeandbrew.com. Hey, Von, how are you?
Hey, Bob, doing great. How are you doing today?
We are outstanding here in Toledo. Thanks so much. I got to say, we're doing better in Toledo than I think probably most fans in Ann Arbor are right now. What the hell is going on with the recruiting of Coach Jim Harbaugh? The big story that I'm reading today is not of guys that they signed. It's about the guys that got away. Four-star linebacker Otis Reese, who was a commit, has been a commit since June, I think, of 2016. Decided at the last second, he's from Georgia, to stay in Georgia. He's going to go and play for the University of Georgia. And then there was a second recruit who was, it's Kevin Doyle, a quarterback recruit. Decommitting from his verbal commitment to Michigan, Kevin Doyle has moved on, and he has signed with Arizona. So, a couple of pretty big names, a couple of disappointing outcomes. What can you tell us from Camp Harbaugh?
Yeah, well, losing Otis Reese was a bit of a surprise to a lot of the people associated with the program. Like you said, he had been committed, verbally committed at least, since June of 2016. So they've been recruiting him for about a year and a half now. And last second, he just flips, goes to Georgia. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, Georgia was in the national championship game this past season, and they were about a play or two away from actually winning it. Kirby Smart's done an incredible job down in Georgia his first couple seasons there. I think what you're seeing with Georgia is kind of a lot of what we saw with Jim Harbaugh's first couple classes. 2016, he had a really good class. 2017, it was number five nationally. You started to get some of these five-star guys, Rashawn Gary, Donovan Peoples-Jones, Aubrey Sullivan. It's not common for them to lose some of these recruits. It does hurt, but I don't think it hurts as much with Otis Reese flipping to go into Georgia. He is a linebacker. That is a position that Michigan's pretty well off at, quite honestly. They had a couple top 100 guys last season in the recruiting classes, Drew Singleton being one of them, and Jordan Anthony being the other. Those guys were both top 100 recruits, both four-stars. Very highly recruited linebackers, so I would assume that they're going to get some playing time this season. And, of course, they still have Devin Bush as a junior. Khalik Hudson's coming back, so I'm not too concerned with the linebacker. And you bring up Kevin Doyle. That one kind of was a little bit less surprising, especially with Shea Patterson coming in from Ole Miss, the transfer. Assuming that he gets eligibility to play this season, he's going to be one of the top guys on the depth chart. Joe Milton coming in, four-star. He's going to be a really talented guy when it's all said and done. You assume that he's probably going to get some playing time at some point. And then they still got Dylan McCaffrey, four-star from last year, and, of course, Brandon Peters. So I would say that one was a bit less surprising than Otis Reese, just because of how long he's been committed to the program. And You know, a lot of people within the program were kind of expecting Kevin Doyle to decommit and end up going to Arizona. He had been waiting for that scholarship to be extended his way. He decommitted on Super Bowl Sunday, actually. It wasn't too far behind the Super Bowl starting, and it was about 20 minutes after that that he had tweeted that he had received a scholarship from the University of Arizona. So it was pretty much all said and done at that point. All he had to really do was sign the letter of intent, and it was pretty much a done deal for Arizona.
We are talking with Von Lozon, who writes about Michigan football for MaizeAndBrew.com, and we're looking at the Michigan recruiting class on today, the second of two national signing days. Now the first one back on December 20th. Do you like this, or do you find this a little bit, like we talked about it before, a little bit anticlimactic, since so many of the biggest names, you know, five- and four-star recruits were locked up early on in December?
It is a little bit more anticlimactic. To be honest with you, Michigan had just about everybody from their recruiting class sign in that early signing period in December. I think they only had three or four uncommitted players at that point. That didn't sign their letter of intent in December. So it was really just a matter of the cornerback, Vincent Gray, signing, and then Michael Barrett, who was a late guy that committed there, three-star athlete. He's from Georgia. And then Ronnie Bell, the wide receiver. He's from Kansas City, Missouri. He was the third and final guy that they had to sign up on the traditional signing day, if you will. Today, so it is a little bit more anticlimactic. It didn't seem to be a whole lot of action. Of course, there are still a couple five-star guys like Nicholas Petit Frere. He was in the running for a plethora of really big colleges, and he ended up going to Ohio State. And the number one overall cornerback recruit was still unsigned up until today. I think he ended up going to Alabama. So, you know, there was some excitement, but definitely not as much as years past.
Von, I've got to ask you this, and I'm not trying to pile on in any way, shape, or form. I'm really not trying to be negative about Michigan, but this is year four now for Jim Harbaugh. You know, these are his recruits. This is his team. They had the worst year of their 3 years this past season in terms of overall record. His record against Ohio State and Penn State, as we all know, is abysmal. He has not yet beaten the Buckeyes. And I'm looking at just this class. Now, this is just one recruiting analysis. You know, 24/7 Sports says Georgia has the best class. Ohio State has the second best class. Penn State has the fourth best class. And Michigan is down there at number 20. Now, we all know that these are all very subjective, and we all know this is just guessing how high school players are going to develop and what kind of careers they're going to have, et cetera, et cetera. But it is what it is, and we go by these things. Can Michigan afford to have the 20th best recruiting class when they are trying to close what seems to be a widening gap rather than a narrowing gap between themselves and Ohio State, and even to a degree their other huge rival, at least in terms of you know, Big Ten standings, Penn State?
You know, that's a really good question, honestly. And if you're talking about it from narrowing the gap with the Buckeyes, I would say no, you can't afford that. Obviously, you want to hit with those five-star guys that you were recruiting this entire time, like Petit Frere, and that's a position of need for Michigan is offensive line, especially at the tackle position. They're going to have some big problems next year if Grant Newsom, the tackle that had a season-ending knee injury in 2016, and he didn't play this past season. If he's not able to come back, you're going to have some even bigger questions at left tackle and at right tackle. So, you know, when it comes to that question specifically, I would say no, you can't afford it, especially with the fact that Ohio State, like you said, has the second highest ranked recruiting class this season. They have multiple five-star guys. They have a ton of top 100 talents, according to the 247 Sports composite. And Michigan right now has zero. Their highest ranked player is Aiden Hutchinson. He's a defensive end, and he's ranked at 112. So from that standpoint, no, they can't afford it. And, you know, I think it has to be questioned a little bit, you know, why they can't lock in these top guys to commit to the University of Michigan. I think a lot of it has to do, like you said, again, with this past season, them going 8-5. They lost their bowl game. Yeah. And all of these losses that they had to Penn State. It was a blowout. Michigan State, it wasn't necessarily a blowout, but it was a very sloppy game where he had five turnovers. And obviously, if national recruits like Petit Frere, for example, are sitting down on a Saturday night and watching Michigan play Michigan State on ABC prime time, and Michigan ends up losing that game, most of the time, I don't think that they're going to take away a very good impression of how a Jim Harbaugh-led team is really approaching these games. You know, Ohio State was a little bit different this season. They fought very hard at home in a game that they probably shouldn't have really had a whole lot of business competing in. But when it comes to Penn State and to, you know, the South Carolina Bowl game, the Outback Bowl, it wasn't the best result that you could really leave, especially when you're trying to get these recruits so late in the game, and especially with this early signing period now, it's more important than ever to get those big-time guys in that December period. So, you know, it's a mixed bag sort of things with why they can't, you know, close the deal. But they do have some transfers. You know, like I said, Shea Patterson, that's a huge addition, regardless of if he's in this recruiting class or not. They're still going after Calvin Anderson, a graduate transfer offensive lineman. He's considering Michigan and Texas and a few other southern schools, Auburn being one of them. So if they end up getting, you know, a few of these transfers, it won't look as bad in my eyes. I don't know how other Michigan fans feel about it, but we'll just have to wait and see until that's all said and done.
We're talking with Von Lozon of Mazin Blue, or excuse me, MazinBrew.com about the Michigan recruiting class. Harbaugh's style appears to have changed. You know, in those first couple of years, and particularly last year, you know, the whole, you know, sleeping over at a recruit's house, the kicker's house, and all of these things that were just very, very, a lot of flair, a lot of drama, a lot of, you know, fun stuff. Boy, you know, it's got to be so much fun to come and play for Michigan. You know, he really went all out. Now, it appears anyway from here, from Toledo, maybe different up there, that he was much more low-key in this recruiting period, in this recruiting year. Is that by design, and do you think that hurt him? Does he need to be kind of, you know, out there and flashy and colorful the way he was before?
Yeah, you know, it does seem that he's kind of mellowed out a little bit. There was a quote that he had this past season that it was after one of the big losses they had, whether it's Penn State or Michigan State, whoever it may have been. I believe it was something along the lines of that, you know, he doesn't really have emotion when it comes to losing games. He just wants to get past it. And that's not something that you really saw out of Harbaugh the first couple of years, especially after that Ohio State game in 2016. He was as fired up for any game as he's probably ever been after that game, and, you know, kind of unloaded on the media and the, especially with the officials and things like that. You know, he had that flair. He had that passion. This past season, he didn't really have that flair, especially on the sidelines. He was, like you said, a lot more low key. You know, didn't really get fired up all that often. I can't really recall a single time where, you know, he was either fist pumping or, you know, getting prepared in a heated way like you would have used to see Jim Harbaugh doing that. But it did change a little bit on the recruiting trail as well. He's, like you said, he's not sleeping over kids' houses. He's not jumping into pools like he did last year for Oliver Martin, yeah, wide receiver. No, he's not really doing a whole lot of it. He's really just, you know, flying to these kids' high schools, you know, kind of shaking their hand, introducing himself, and laying out what Michigan has to offer, and, you know, we'll, our people will get in touch with your people, pretty much. So it has changed a little bit. Whether that affected recruiting this season, I'm not so sure, because they do have some pretty big recruits in their 2019 class already verbally committed. Now, again, verbal commitment, Otis Reese, he kind of disproved all of the importance of verbal commits, but as of right now, the verbal commitments are looking pretty good. They've got three top 100 guys in the 2019 class already verbally committed. So, you know, I'm not sure if it's affecting recruiting, but I, you know, as a Michigan fan, Michigan guy, that was so used to seeing Harbaugh so fiery on the sideline, you would like to see a little bit more out of that.
I think
you know, come next season.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think 8-5, maybe it's hard to be flashy and aggressive like that when you aren't really showing the results that maybe you think kids want to see. They want to go out there and play for national championships, play for Big Ten championships and those kind of things. And those opportunities just haven't been there for the Wolverines since Harbaugh took over. By the way, in case you're wondering, other rankings, at least for 24/7 Sports, Michigan State, the 31st best class, Notre Dame, the 10th best recruiting class this year thus far, Toledo, number 64 in the country, and Bowling Green number 96. Just wanted to throw that out there for local fans' consumption. Vaughn, really good talking to you. I hope we can talk again because you're obviously dialed in. You guys over at Amazing Brew do a great job, and we'd love to have you back the next time we talk Michigan football.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
You got it. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much. There it is. That is going to do it for us. We are out of time. It's just 4 minutes before the top of the hour. We got to clear the decks because Mike Miller, I got to tell you, when he comes in to grab the microphone, you do not stand in the way. Just let the man have his show and let him go. Mike Miller is up next for your drive time. Thanks again to Vaughn for joining us. Thanks to Dennis Maniloff, who joined us earlier. Tomorrow we're back again at 3 o'clock. We'll analyze the Cavaliers' latest beatdown, which should come in a few hours. Beatdown, that would be, at the hands of the Minnesota Timberwolves. And maybe another Pistons victory as they look for five in a row. All that will be a part of tomorrow's show. Have yourself a great night. Stay here for Draft Time. Bye-bye.